Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna
have, oh yeah, we did. We started to burn too many things we found. Back to the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Great to have you with us today. And we are entering the area of the unreality show of the Donald Trump extravaganza. I got to say that in terms of political theater of the absurd, and I didn't watch the whole thing. I only saw clips of it on Jimmy Fallon or whatever, but Donald Trump press conference has to be one of the most insane things I have ever seen in American politics. You know, unfortunately, he's probably not going to do another press conference for a year or two, but that one was truly spectacular as the fascists march into power here in the United States of America, or what's left of it. We are facing a truly bizarre situation. I've got great guests today, Jim and Mary Beth from Eon, the great filmmakers in Northern California, Bolinas area, the town that does not want to be found. And Bob Petraeus is going to be with us for a while to talk about all this political stuff. And then at the half hour, we're going to be joined by Carl Grossman, the fantastic nuclear reporter from Long Island, to talk to us about more about Donald Trump and about the shutdown of Indian Point, which is a huge victory, although mixed bag for the anti-nuclear movement. And, of course, we don't know what the Trump is going to bring us in terms of nuclear, but he's going to certainly push like hell since he seems to have some investments in atomic energy. We want to start off talking with Jim and Mary Beth. Jim and Mary Beth, are you with us?
We are.
You are from Northern California. Bob Petraeus, you on?
Let me quote from H.L. Mencken before you.
Yeah,
please.
Well, I think he was referring to Warren G. Harding. But at least Warren G. Harding was he wasn't a total jerk. Warren G. Harding was not a jerk. Warren G. Harding wasn't the brightest bulb on the
street. He left them out of jail and brought them to the White House.
Absolutely. Warren G. Harding at least freed Eugene V. Debs, had a definite strain of moral decency about him. He's a nice guy. I have never heard anyone accuse Donald Trump of being a nice guy. I mean, that is something that we do not hear. I got to tell you guys, before we jump into this, I am absolutely thrilled that he is not going to divest from his business interests. I mean, this is going to be such a show to see this guy standing up there with his investments being managed by his kids is with his full knowledge. There's no blind trust here. He just wants to sit there and have them operate his businesses while he, as President of the United States, makes decisions that's going to make him billions of dollars. This is completely out to lunch, unprecedented, totally astounding. I mean, it is. This guy really has no sense. As Joseph Welch once said, after all, sir, have you no sense of decency? I mean, come on. It's astounding. Bob, as a political scientist, I don't think there's any precedent for this, is there? I mean, presidents have to divest their financial interests, don't they?
Well, you know, who knows in the great era of the robber barons when the rich used to outright own anything. But in modern times, you know, it really is unprecedented.
Totally astounding. Completely amazing. So, Jim and Mary Beth, I want to start with you because I'm playing off an article you wrote. And, Bob, you've also got a great piece up on freepress.org. Let's start with Jim and Mary Beth. Jim, you put out a piece that's running around the Internet from Eon Films, E-O-N Films. Tell us about the piece you've got up there and your discussion of Putin and the whole charade here of the hacking of the election.
Well, I guess I've been contaminated by association with you guys because I have a very, jaundiced view of the whole process. The article you're talking about seems to be getting legs. It's called Mind Fogged in the Nuclear Anthropocene. And maybe I better unpack that first of all. The idea
this is a family show, so we don't have words on this show that have more than three syllables. So you gotta lay this one down. Let's hear it.
Yeah, well, I want to stretch your syllabic capacity here. First of all, the Anthropocene is a term that's come into some currency in the last couple of years. It was coined by geologists to reflect the notion and their evidence that human activity has now become such an impactful influence on the planet and all its life forms that we should really call this new geological period the Anthropocene, meaning the era of human beings. There's a convention in geology to name various eras of the past, like the Pliocene and the Miocene and the Oligocene and the Pleistocene. So now we have the Anthropocene, meaning that human activity is determinative of this current era. But you also have to add to that the concept of the nuclear Anthropocene, because nuclear activity has already altered the planet and its life forms in many ways through its impact on the genetic code of all living beings. So that's what is meant now by the nuclear Anthropocene. I thought I came up with the term, but once I Googled it, I realized that other people, particularly in Britain, have begun using the term as well. So
does that mean that Donald Trump is actually a nuclear mutant, and that's what's happened here?
I suppose you could build a case for that, yeah. And but this is all in the context of we're now in terrible trouble, as the song says. Because Donald Trump is about to get the launch codes for the American nuclear arsenal. And once he gets his little hands on that and his tiny finger on the button, we're just a tweet away from Armageddon. You know? So we need to be thinking about this. And the fact that, as Mary Beth has pointed out, the dysfunctionality of our electoral system and the peril that we're in because of the possible nuclear annihilation are intimately connected, and that's the point that I was making in this article.
And, of course, you also talk about the distraction of Putin. Bob Fetrakis, as my co-conspirator on X million articles about the theft of this election, you got a piece up at freepress.org. Tell us about that one.
Oh, on the whole question of the recount itself, which was more of a joke than the election. But it really calls into a question whether the federal government itself ensured a Republican form of government. There's nothing that seems to indicate that any of the recounts were in fact illegal. And as you co-wrote with me, Harvey, you know, first you've got the primary problem where none of the numbers seem to match in 12 key states. for Hillary Clinton when she beat Bernie Sanders. And then this just weird process where Trump's numbers don't seem to match, and you've got an antiquated system where, of course, you can win by 3 million votes and lose the election. The fact that we're still using the racist-based electoral college, as you've pointed out many times, Harvey, and that the loser, by a significant amount of votes, can actually win the election calls into question the very legitimacy of our government.
Well, it's happened six times now in U.S. history. Thomas Jefferson was not the legitimate winner in 1800, although no one talks about that. They all talk about this big thing that happened with Aaron Burr, but the fact is, if it weren't for the three-fifths bonus, Jefferson wouldn't have been president. John Quincy Adams in 1824, Russell V. Hayes in 1876, Benjamin Harrison in 1884, and then George W. Bush in 2000, and now Trump in 2016. And what's astounding to me, and dangerous and ridiculous, is that everybody's yelling and screaming about Putin here, and nobody's talking about the Electoral College, and nobody's talking about what Bob, you and I, and Jim and Mary Beth have been writing and filming about for 16 years now, is the fact that the elections are stripped, millions of people are taken off the voter rolls, and then flipped by electronic voting machines, which was clearly done this year, and the Democratic Party has said nothing about this. Even at this point in time, it's staggering to me. And I want to ask you both, actually, all three of you, Mary Beth, you're on the line too. How many votes do you think Hillary would have won by if people were not stripped and the votes were not flipped? Do we have any estimation of what of Clinton's legitimate vote margin might have been?
Well, as Bob rightly said, there's no way really to know at this point because the whole electoral system is so corrupted. And it isn't just, as you guys pointed out in your excellent book about the stripping and flipping, it wasn't just that. It was also the takeover, basically, of the electoral process by a small group of billionaires, mainly in the circle of the Koch brothers, who have funded over the last two decades the complete debasement of the whole political process, including gerrymandering states, particularly ones that are key to winning the Electoral College vote, as well as all kinds of think tanks and at state and federal level shenanigans, front groups, astroturf groups. So what we see now, it's been a funny process because it seemed like now the Koch brothers and their billionaire pals were essentially trying to supplant the Republican Party. And now another billionaire has showed up and kind of stolen the whole apparatus from the Koch brothers. But like you say, what we're seeing here is a wrecking crew being assembled that, you know, is unprecedented in history, probably.
Bob, do you, as a political scientist, do you have any estimation of what you think Clinton's legitimate margin might have been over the 3 million?
I mean, that's hard to answer because take a state just like Ohio, where not only do you got a problem with a 8.5% unexplained deviation for Trump, but in the run-up to the election, a million people were purged from the voting rolls. And our best calculation is that that's about a 70 to 30 shift for Hillary Clinton. So Ohio itself should not have been close. It was probably a 400,000 pickup for Clinton had the Democratic Party fought of all. I mean, the big issue is why weren't there sit-ins? Why isn't there a new civil rights movement? Why can a non-entity like John Husted, the Secretary of State, simply purge urban voters and allow the padded rolls in these rural white counties to continue, and there's no real resistance from the Democratic Party itself. I mean, really, they won the vote for Trump or made it close. That's the strip and flip prior to the election. And then when they don't have enough votes, suddenly, you know, the Columbus Dispatch, which does a mail-in ballot that's historically accurate, has, you know, Clinton winning by 1 point. And then the exit polls are showing a toss-up in Ohio, and we accept the fact that Trump won by a statistically impossible 8.5%. I mean, these private companies, while we keep thinking about Russian hackers, what about these private companies often tied directly to the Republican Party or the Right to Life movement that have the poll books, you know, the Triad, which is the Rapp family, that's one of the leading Right to Life groups in Ohio, are controlling the actual poll books. So people show up disproportionately Democrat, disproportionately Black, minority, and poor, and found that their names are no longer on the voting rolls. How is this allowed in the United States?
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, we have this pretense to be a democracy, and the whole system is completely shot. The only good thing we know now is that Donald Trump is in there with no, I mean, he's a completely illegitimate ruler. The Democrats are giving a pretty easy ride to his insane cabinet picks. I mean, they let Jeff Sessions pretty much slide through. I don't expect much from the Democrats at all. I mean, do you guys? Mary Beth, you haven't jumped in here.
You know, I've been wondering, what is it with the Democrats? For instance, way back when the Republicans started the gerrymandering strategy, where were the Democrats? Why did they allow it then? So I was very interested in an article recently, and I can't remember the name of the author, who pointed out that what happened is that the Democrats have consistently chosen to maintain party power rather than winning. Because if they, for instance, had backed Bernie, they would not have been the Democrats that are currently in power and who chose to maintain their positions would not have remained in office because of the populist vote would have swept them out probably, and their tendencies to vote Republican light would not have been received well anymore. And so I thought that was very helpful to understanding what's going on with the Democrats. They don't see themselves as really vying so much for all-out victory here or on behalf of the people. They want to maintain their current political power structure.
Well, clearly the Democrats were more comfortable having Donald Trump as president than Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that, Bob? As a political scientist, do you think that's the case?
That the preference would be for Trump over Sanders?
The corporate Democrats would appear to be more.
Absolutely, and I think the rise of the Democratic Leadership Council in 1984, you know, made that very clear. That was a direct move to the center. You know, here in Columbus, Ohio, progressives and left-wingers were purged from the local county apparatus in Columbus, primarily because they were, you know, social Democrats, liberals, and progressives. So I think, you know, when your system is absolutely saturated with corporate money, it's true now much more than it was in 84 when they began to go after the DLC, the corporate money, and came up with their candidate, Bill Clinton. But now, after Citizens United, it's even more true, is that what they hadn't anticipated was someone like Sanders being able to raise, you know, tens of millions of dollars from small donors. But that clearly they were very comfortable with neoliberalism, free trade policies, and hawkish neoconservative war policies. And Sanders challenged both of those things. So they were very uncomfortable with an outsider who really had never been associated to any great extent with the Democratic Party. He was an independent coming out of Vermont, challenging, you know, the corporate Democratic establishment.
Yeah, they really, as Sarah, what's her name, at the convention said, the comedian, what's her name, Sarah?
Silverman.
Yeah, Sarah Silverman, yeah, who I used to like, actually, but, you know, she said, you're being ridiculous. I mean, you know, the Bernie people were, in fact, ridiculous in terms of the needs of the corporate mainstream Democrats, and, of course, Deborah Wasserman Schultz. No relation. I am circulating a petition, again, to have her drop that middle name, but she's no longer a factor, so it doesn't bother me as much. And so now the payback is Donald Trump. I personally think, and I'd like to hear from you guys in the few minutes we have left, I think that Trump's refusal to separate from his business interests, to divest his business interests, is really going to clobber his presidency. I don't see how he's going to be able to really operate that way, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, he's a traditional third world kleptocrat here. He's no different than Marcos or Suharto or Mobutu or Somoza or Pinochet, all these fascist right-wing kleptocrats who had no real ideology except making themselves rich. He has really put themselves at the pinnacle. Do you think this is going to hurt him, Jim, and Mary Beth and Bob? I mean, how does this play out in terms of Trump's presidency?
I think it clearly puts his whole administration and its future under the shadow of doubt. But the other part of it is that these new revelations, or at least allegations, about the Russian connections, you might call it the Golden Showers papers, you know, really make people wonder whether as LBJ would say, his tiny pecker is in Putin's pocket.
Well, I want to just interject. I'm hoping that his global business dealings will make him more hesitant to push the button on the nuclear option. I'm hoping that it'll at least make him more protective of the global environment somehow. Because if he has interests all over, and if that's his primary motivation, hopefully, you know, he's not going to be so trigger happy.
Yeah, I mean, a nuclear war will cost him a lot of money. What do you think? I mean, is he just going to get gone under the cover of the rug that he won't divest his business interests?
You know, well, that too. The many issues raised currently going on with regard to both nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and nuclear weapons. It's a horrendous time for a guy like Trump to be, you know, in such an important position.
It is. It's a nightmare. Bob, as a political scientist, is there any precedent? I mean, what do you think is going to happen with this guy's business? Do you think it'll hurt him that he's refusing to divest?
I think it makes him impeachable. I mean, what he's and the reality is, you know, like Marco Rubio and others, he's made some enemies, very powerful, Republicans that are in the Senate. I mean, a variety of stuff that's been happening. He's all over the place. You may have seen that he appointed Robert Kennedy Jr. To a vaccine panel.
Right.
Yeah, which, I saw that.
That was interesting.
Which, I think is important. But what he's missing, I mean, what people aren't talking about to a great extent is his appointment from Breitbart of Bannon.
Oh.
Is that the ideology underscoring that is the clash of cultures, Huntington's famous theory, and in part as white right-wing nationalists, which was his base that he pandered to, see Christian, albeit Eastern Orthodox, Russia as a natural ally against the spread of Islamic culture. So that's what's going on there. But what it allowed to some extent to happen was even a more dangerous policy by the neoconservative, which was virtually the complete surrounding of Russia with NATO forces. James Baker, during Bush the Elder's presidency, when the Soviet Union collapsed, said that we wouldn't go an inch into Eastern Europe. And now, you know, we're spending billions of dollars moving NATO forces into the Baltic states. Hillary Clinton and Obama backed a coup, of course, in the Ukraine, which led to the problem there. What Putin is doing in many ways is very logical because of what the neoconservatives did in that area. And recall that Project Censored said the number one censored story in the United States was the massive expansion of U.S. forces all over the globe under Clinton and under the Obama administration, where there was an 80% increase in nations that now have a U.S. military parked on their soil. So Trump, in many ways, was the reaction to a variety of things happening. On the one hand, it's actually positive that he may have some relationship with Putin to ignore this massive global imperial buildup of U.S. forces worldwide. On the other hand, he seems to replace Russia, as a potential enemy because of their Christian ways with problems clearly with China and Mexico.
Well, we're joined now by Carl Grossman. Carl, are you with us?
I'm right here, Robbie. Pleasure to be
good,
here.
Good, good, good. And I know, Bob, you may have to leave. Let us know if you need to jump off. Jim and Mary Beth, you're welcome to stay. Of course, you're all welcome to stay.
I'll be leaving now, although I'll make sure I continue to listen to Carl because I'm really interested in his perspective.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, thank you so much, Bob Petrakis, my co-author with so many books, including The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016, soon to become the Strip and Flip Disaster of America's Experience with Stolen Elections. I guess to a certain extent, I do want to talk about the shutdown of Indian Point. Jim and Mary Beth, your experiences with Diablo Canyon will be certainly relevant to that. But I do think in the short term, and Carl, you're welcome to comment on this, Donald Trump may, beating Hillary Clinton like this may have saved us from a war with Russia. The question is, do we now go to war with China? I mean, all the elements are there. Trump doesn't seem to like the Chinese very much. Probably doesn't like Chinese food either. And I don't know, Carl, you're in a restaurant. Are you in a Chinese restaurant? What's the deal here?
They call them a fusion restaurant now, Harvey.
Fusion.
It's Japanese and it's Chinese. So maybe even Trump could find something that would make him happy.
Well, what do you think here with Trump and nuclear? Now, you are on Long Island. You have been reporting, as Jim and Mary Beth have, on Diablo for so many years. You've been reporting on Indian Point. there is now an announcement that Indian Point will shut. So can, and you've got a great article up at the Counterpoint and Counterpunch and nukefree.org. And tell us what's happening here with Indian Point, the nuclear plant.
Well, it's very, very good news. These two nuclear plants, and they've been called accidents waiting to happen. They've been called disasters waiting to happen. But as you, Harvey, you've been far more precise. They are disasters that are happening. Accident after accident, what they're doing to marine life in the Hudson River, the leakage of tritium affecting the water that people drink up there. I mean, the horror stories. And if you had a catastrophic accident, and you easily could at either of those two Indian Point plants, and the wind was blowing from the north, as it often does, you have the city of New York 26 miles away. That's the Bronx line. Furthermore, you have over 20 million people living within a 50-mile radius of the two Indian Point plants. People always should remember that in the wake of the beginnings of the Fukushima disaster, what the U.S. State Department did was to advise U.S. citizens within 50 miles of Fukushima to evacuate. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission still holds on to the fiction. We should only be concerned about a 10-mile emergency zone. No, 50 miles. And within 50 miles of those nuclear plants it's the population center of the United States. Furthermore, both of them are over 40 years old. They've been running in recent times without a license because the 40-year licenses to operate expired. So what has been done here, led by Governor Andrew Cuomo, and I've been critical about Andrew Cuomo on the nuclear issue on a number of levels. He's been attempted in 2016. He pushed a bailout for upstate nuclear power plants, he said, should get support by New York ratepayers because they provide carbon-free energy, really. So, again, with that said, in this situation, Andrew Cuomo, the New York Attorney General Schneiderman, activist groups, River Keeper and Clearwater, and they've been working so hard for so many decades, must be congratulated for getting this energy to say, we're going to give up. It's over. One of the nukes will shut based on this agreement in 2020, the other one in 2021. But that's still a few years away. And better keep our fingers crossed nothing disastrous happens in the meantime. But the shutdown of these two Indian Point plants, in my judgment, colossally good news for the people of the Northeast, the people in the Northeast. The bad news, and we've been talking about, and it's the very bad news, we've been talking about a New Yorker, Donald Trump, is that Trump is a pro-nuker. In fact, this was divulged by Bloomberg News about a month ago, a big article about a Trump transition team, the headline in Bloomberg News, asking for ways to keep nuclear power alive. And I suspect that we're going to see under Trump this baloney argument, this argument that unfortunately Andrew Cuomo fell for when it came to those upstate plants, that nuclear is carbon-free, accepted. And I think you're going to see an attempt, the Trump administration, to continue to try to bail out and fortify the nuclear industry. And never still will people be told it isn't that a nuclear reactor, the issue of a nuclear reactor and greenhouse gases. When you look at, and this is the key here, when you look at the nuclear fuel cycle, the nuclear chain, mining, milling, enriching, fabrication, and so forth, it's loaded with the emission of carbon dioxide, with the emission of greenhouse gases. If one wants to go to carbon-free energy, if one goes to solar and wind, and we go to, as you called it, solartopia, that's clean, that's green, that's correct. But this guy, this fellow Trump, and I'm a New Yorker all my life, and I also, I'm from Queens. I grew up just a couple of miles from Jamaica Estates where Donald Trump did. I know where he's from, and I know about him. This is an unpredictable situation with a man who is not all there. And just the last thing I'd like to say in terms of nuclear, whether it's nuclear power or nuclear weapons, he doesn't seem to put it very mildly, get it at all. In fact, there was the report again last year of him saying at a briefing, look, we've got nuclear weapons. Well, why don't we use them? Why don't we use them? And as Hillary Clinton properly pointed out time and again during the campaign, a man with this thin skin, with this temperament, I mean, just consider what he did to Meryl Streep just a couple of days ago. Tweet after tweet, an early morning interview with the New York Times, carrying on with Meryl Streep. If this is the way this guy operates, hyper-emotionally, thin-skinned, and he thinks that, hey, we got nuclear weapons, why not use them? The next several years represent, in my, and I don't want to sound like Cassandra here, represent a challenge of survivability like we've never, ever had.
Well, I agree with that. And I think, and I've got a piece going up on theprogressive.org in the next day or two, basically warning that the most important danger that we face under Trump is not necessarily nuclear weapons, but it's the nuclear power plants. Because these things are going to go unregulated. They're, you know, you've got these clowns running around the country getting huge taxpayer bailouts to keep them operating. We have you guys, Jim and Mary Beth, are in California, and Carl, you're in New York. So we have the four worst or most dangerous reactors, I think, two at Diablo Canyon and the two at Indian Point, scheduled for shutdown. But these deals are very complicated now. In California, Jim and Mary Beth, they have the option to keep operating until, what, 2025, 2024
right.
at least. And there are escape clauses in these deals. And the one, as I read it, Carl, in New York, if they don't get replacement power, they can keep operating Indian Point. Is that true?
It's not as bad as that. But and on Governor Cuomo's website is the actual agreement. What it says is that if there is an emergency situation and the state can contest this, and they talk about terrorism and this and that, war and so forth, then each of the plants can have their operating lives extended each 2 years. The folks who negotiated this agreement, and they're smart people, tried to limit what could easily be an escape clause. So I'm not too concerned about that. What I am concerned about in terms of the equation here is that the key reason that Indian Point is closing, I mean, obviously this has been political activism for many years. There's been an effort by New York State, which is very important, to deal in an area which is not preempted by the feds, to challenge what's called the speedies permit. In other words, Indian Point has once through cooling. Pink Nuke takes a million gallons a minute of coolant. And what the state has been saying is because the devastating impact done by the two Indian Point plants to marine life, to zillions of fish constantly, you got to build towers there, Entity. You got to build cooling towers. And that's too expensive to Entergy. So that was a key element. And the other key element, beyond, again, the activism and the work and so forth, was that competitive power has gotten competitive. And obviously I'm not going to speak about gas from fracking as being an alternative in any way to nuclear power. I mean, in terms of climate change and global warming and just the pollution caused by fracking, that's a horror story in and of itself. But the big challenge is Solartopia. The fact that we now have solar coming down precipitously in price, the panels, going up like rocket ships in terms of efficiency. We have wind turbines. In fact, just a few weeks ago, the first offshore wind farm in the United States began operation off eastern Long Island, off Block Island, five wind turbines. And the company that developed that particular technology to put these wind turbines way out of sight so people aren't concerned about aesthetic intrusion, deep water wind, is pushing ahead. In fact, just in the last couple of days, Andrew Cuomo has given full support to this, to wind farms with many, many, many more than five wind turbines off other areas of Long Island, off New Jersey, and so forth. In other words, we could have safe, clean, renewable energy, which we all can live with technologically. I mean, it's here. It's a renewable energy bonanza that we're seeing, a revolution. My concern is that Trump not only is going to try to promote nuclear power with bailouts and what have you, but also discourage the development or the implementation, I mean, doesn't need to be developed anymore. I mean, it's here today. It's all on the shelf. The implementation of safe, clean, green energy. And you should consider the crew of folks that he is bringing into Washington, whether it's the Department of Energy or the EPA or Department of Interior. We're talking about anti-environmentalists of the first order. I wrote a book when Reagan got in back in 1980 called The Poison Conspiracy. And the back of the book, you can get a used copy at Amazon, the back of the book is a listing of some of the people that, in fact, many of the people that Reagan appointed to EPA, to OSHA, foxes, one after another, foxes to guard the case. I think what we're seeing has been, and I'm afraid will continue to be, Trump in terms of this type of anti-environmentalist, this type of anti-safe energy person outfoxing Reagan.
Jim and Mary Beth, you're in California. You're facing a similar situation at Diablo Canyon. There is a deal to shut the plant. What do you see as the parallels with Indian Point and Diablo Canyon?
In addition to the ongoing devastation to the marine life and the ocean, in our case, the ocean, the production of more waste that's going to be stuck there. That's the other part of the equation that's just so horrendous. And in our case, and I think probably with your case too, we have an overdue huge earthquake that's being predicted. For a long time it's been said that it was going to happen in a year, and Diablo Canyon is in a tsunami zone and surrounded by 13 earthquake faults.
Well, is there any chance that either of these two sets of reactors can be shut early, earlier than the deals have laid out?
Well, there is a movement, you know, to try to get that done in the case of Diablo. But this deal, really, you can't regard it as a final thing because the State Utilities Commission could easily put the kibosh on it, and Edison PG&E could easily withdraw from the deal. But there's a more serious impact, I think, on the whole Solartopian vision, and that is that the 10-year period, roughly 10 years, that it gives PG&E to change its business model slightly is going to give it a leg up on getting really a monopoly grip on renewable power sources rather than rooftop solar and distributed generation and microgrids. It's, their hope, as I read it, is to block all that from going on, and meanwhile set up their own highly centralized, privately owned solar and wind farm installations. So, Harvey, you've very appropriately coined the meme for a solartopian transition in California, but I think that very arrangement that they've managed to bring this far is a danger to that vision.
Carl Grossman, what's going to happen with renewables in New York now? You know, Cuomo has put up $7.7 billion to keep these insane reactors operating upstate, and now he's shutting the two downstate. Where does wind and solar fit into all this in New York?
Cuomo announced several months ago a 2030 plan. 50% of electricity in New York would come from clean sources. The problem is that he included these four also aged, troubled, plagued, problematic nuclear plants upstate under the carbon-free, the clean category. There's a big battle on over that. He's facing harsh criticism. In fact, I just was in contact today with an attorney who was preparing papers for an injunction to stop this over $7 billion bailout. I mean, under this scheme, all the electric ratepayers in New York would be there would be a surcharge on the electric bill to pay for these this Patrick plant and this 9 Mile plant. There's two of the most. It's he's so misguided, and he says, "Well, it's for the jobs." It's very, very few jobs there. And analysis done show that if that kind of money, that kind of billions of dollars, were directed to solartopia, to more offshore wind, to more solar, to other. I mean, when we're talking about safe, clean, renewable energy, you've written a lot about this. I have, Harvey. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's here. Energy, we can live with safe energy. But Cuomo made a big mistake on that. He's facing pressure. He's facing pressure from the New York State Legislature on this as well. And hopefully, maybe, I mean, after the, this experience he's had with Indian Point, and in fact, the great support he is getting. I mean, you're seeing now in New York papers about Cuomo being possibly a presidential candidate. He'll be running for a third term, possibly a presidential candidate, an anti-Trump. And if he wants to embrace clean energy, I mean, truly clean energy, I think here in New York, we're going to see a lot of backing for him, and that might enable the state to push even stronger, because it doesn't have to be 50 by 30. It could be 100% renewable. There are areas all over this country, back where I live on the end of Long Island, the town of East Hampton has committed itself to 100% renewable in just 4 years from now. 4 years from now, with a combination of solar and offshore wind and so forth. Big cities in this country, San Francisco as an example, and others, talking 100% renewable. In New York, in San Francisco, in every city, every state in America, there'll be a different mix depending where you are. We could go 100% renewable, no nukes. No nukes.
Well, I got to say, the biggest piece of news, the most hopeful piece of news I've seen in the last week, has been the announcement by China that they're going to invest over $360 billion in renewable energy by 2020. That's 3 years. That's $100 billion a year. Now, I'm hoping, and I don't, you know, we don't know. It's very hard to get information about China's nuclear power plans, and we've seen that they've had as many as, I've seen up to 36 reactors talked about that they may build new, but this commitment to, and you know, people seem to think that the Chinese are very serious about this, and that they will invest this money.
I mean, that is it. That's a game changer there. If China puts $360 billion into renewables in the next 3 years, they're going to price everything else out of the market. I would hope that that will lead them to cancel all their nuclear plants, and that will certainly tip the balance. Well, Germany has already headed this direction. It could tip the balance in Japan, because my understanding is that, you know, 5 years out from Fukushima, all those reactors are still shut. I mean, they got one or two, like, trickling on, but the citizen movement in Japan seems to have succeeded in keeping the reactors shut. And so if next door China blows in with $360 billion in renewables, what's that going to do, Jim Heller? What do you, and Mary Beth, you think to the energy market in California?
Well, one of the things that I think is really important in this discussion is to understand that the presence of a nuclear power reactor on the grid prevents renewables from coming on at the same time, because they can't be turned off and on to accommodate the variations in the weather and the electrical needs. So that forces the renewables to be thrown off and not used. So it's really exciting to hear that about the Chinese, because that will also probably mean the price going down even more than it already is. Mm-hmm. Of the, I'm sure that they'll have huge economies of scale and even more technical breakthroughs with that kind of expenditure on renewables.
Harvey, with your permission, Jim? I'd like to ask Carl a question about a slightly different issue related here. Is that okay?
Well, let's finish. Okay, yeah, I think we've covered this. And like I say, well, I'm going to say also, I'm going to predict that Trump may come in and try and put tariffs on importing solar panels from China. And we're going to have to watch this very closely. Mm-hmm. I think I can see a trade war on that as he tries to protect the American fossil and nuclear industries. But Jim, go ahead. We only got a few minutes left, actually, so we got to do this really quick.
Okay. Hi, Carl. I'm really honored to be on with you. We've followed your work for years. You recently wrote an article about the looming danger of nuclear weapons in space, and I'm wondering if you would comment on that real quickly.
Yeah, okay, well, you got to be quick, because we're going to start to hear the music.
Yeah, another issue is that Trump, and there's been a number of pieces in the space press, space publications, space news, and so forth, that the Trump team is very interested in the use of weapons. We're talking about the return of the Reagan Star Wars vision, and Star Wars in regards to nuclear, very nuclear based. The architect, I wrote a book, A Weapons in Space, which details, based on governmental documentation, how the battle platforms with the lasers and the hypoelastic guns and the particle beams would have had nuclear reactors on them, providing the energy for these weapons in space. That must be stopped. And I'm very fearful that Trump would be quite open to, in his ignorance and his folly to that. And just let me add, too, this is on a slightly different subject. I think what we have to fear, too, is despotic leadership. Today came the news that one of the great anti-nuclear people, one of the great safe energy, one of the great environmentalists of the world, Dr. Alexei Yablokov, passed away. He was the environmental minister for both Gorbachev and Yeltsin, the Rachel Carson of Russia. And he was my dear friend. And he brought me over to Russia 7 times. We're talking about the 2000s and up till about 7 or 8 years ago. Last speech I made there on nuclear issues was in Siberia. And there was a big effort after 1990 to develop a new energy program for Russia based on Solartopia, based on on safe, clean, green energy. And I was there, I spoke about it, I participated in conferences, actually even spoke at the Russian Academy of Sciences on the relationship between nuclear power and cancer. And I really got deep into the issue in Russia, and then Putin came along. And you have despotic leadership, and now Russia with Putin is pushing nukes. I'd be a little afraid physically, actually, to go back to Russia at this point. With Trump, I think we have the easy possibility of despotic leadership, and that's why it's so important for people. I mean, there's going to be this big demonstration next week in Washington, and there's plans for more and more demonstrations. We all have to, like the saying went years ago, active today or radioactive tomorrow, and a lot of that action, I think, has to be focused on stopping Trump and his, I am sure, many scary, wild, dangerous, and lethal projects and ideas.
Okay, and I'm 100% with you on that. I do want to mention very quickly that Cuomo, the governor of New York, is also starting to talk now about reforming the registration, the electoral system there, and making it easier to get registered to vote. We'll see if that actually happens. No one, after all this time, is talking about electronic voting machines and the flipping of the election. Well, Carl Gross, so much. Jim and Mary Beth, I mean, Bob Petraeus, thank you so much. See you next week. All you guys in New York, thank you. And see you in Silvertopia.
What we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.